Welcome to the HR Room Podcast, the podcast series from Insight HR, where we talk to business leaders from around Ireland and share their advice on how to create the HR systems and workplace culture that's right for your business. For show notes and bonus content, simply visit www.insighthr.ie/podcast. And remember, if you need any HR support, get in touch with us at Insight HR. Whether it's conducting a complex workplace investigation, filling a gap by providing you with a virtual or on-site HR resource, or providing advice via our HR support line, we'll help you resolve whatever human resources challenge your business is facing. Okay, let's get started.
Working in HR can be fun and very rewarding, but it also carries a huge responsibility and can be extremely challenging at times, not least because of the pressure to stay compliant with current legislation, which is often being updated and added to. On today's episode of the HR Room podcast, we're going to be discussing some of the uglier sides of HR, and we're delighted to welcome Anne O'Connell, Principal at Anne O'Connell Solicitors, to our panel today. Thanks for joining us, Anne.
Nice to be here.
We're delighted to have you. And we're also joined by Mary Cullen, Founder and Managing Director of Insight HR. Hello and welcome back, Mary.
Thanks, Sarah.
So, Anne, we might just kick things off perhaps by asking you to tell us a little bit about your background and the kind of work that you're doing at AOC Solicitors.
Thanks, Sarah. I'm 20 years qualified this date. Don't feel so that old, but so I've specialised in employment law throughout my career. I also did a bit of international litigation as well. I trained in the former Byrne Wallace with BCM, Hamdo Wallace at the time, and then moved. And I was worked in William Fryve for 11 years in their employment law department, moved to a smaller firm there then as a partner. And then in 2017, I set up a boutique firm just specialised in employment law. And I do sort of like professional disciplinary aspects that are sort of relate to the same sort of principles as employment law. So we act for both mainly businesses and executives, but employer clients and executives. But we also do get employee, a certain level of employee clients as well, through a lot of referrals. And we act for clients in the various different employment tribunals and labor court. And we also act for clients in the High Court and the odd time as goes Circuit Court, so different applications. And we've get involved in a lot of mediations where employment aspects, disputes are going through mediation, especially if the shareholding is involved. So that would be a general overview.
So 20 years qualified, and I'm sure you've seen a lot over your years in business. What would you say would be some of the most common mistakes that you see HR professionals making?
I think it varies in relation to the aspects, like we're discussing. I think a number of mistakes are actually involved in communication. Mm-hmm. Focusing on the new bit of law that's coming in and forgetting about the foundation principles that are always there, you know, and to follow the procedures and not only follow procedures, but making sure that they keep records, like keeping the records of the communications. And also, I think lack of training of the managers in the business to actually educate the managers and the different people in the company so that they know when they should be going to HR, because I think I hear a lot of HR saying, well, if only the managers came to me sooner, you know, what I didn't know about this. And so educating the managers to sort of come to them sooner, or what they need to be aware of, and, you know, and so that not to, to train them not to react before going back to HR. So they'd be key. And then I think a lot happens in relation to how something is communicated or failure to communicate. I think that escalates an issue, or, you know, or it could be avoided, or de-escalated in relation by methods of communications.
I suppose there's always the worry that if you're asking a question and HR isn't replying to you straight away, you think that the answer is going to be one that you don't necessarily want. So it's important to be kind of transparent there. Mary, you work directly with HR professionals on a day-to-day basis. Do you see some of the same mistakes as Anna's mentioned there?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, I think sometimes HR just take on too much. And they, along with the frontline managers, don't seek advice early enough. And I often think sometimes, you know, spending time strategizing at the outset, maybe with an employment lawyer, makes an awful lot of sense and can save a huge amount of time later. And, you know, I think enough HR people don't always do that. And I'm never really sure why. You know, if you're planning a redundancy process, if you're dealing with a really tricky senior executive issue, if you're trying to manage somebody out of a business, it makes sense to get advice and think these processes through really carefully in advance. And I would agree absolutely with Jan when it comes to communication and documentation of the processes. You know, whatever those processes are, whether it's redundancy consultation minutes or minutes from a disciplinary hearing or a workplace investigation. I think as well, sometimes when we talk about communication, you know, you hear these kind of horror stories where HR and a line manager approach an underperforming employee and kind of put an option to them of, we can do this the nice way, or and you can leave and resign and we'll give you a payout, or we'll bring you through the disciplinary process. And you wonder sometimes, you know, what advice did they get before approaching an employee in that way? And there's, I suppose, more effective ways of bringing around that kind of a conversation. But I think it can be down to poor policy, poorly written policy and procedures, poorly communicated outcomes, poorly communicated, you know, messages to the employee, not enough training of the frontline management, like Anne says, and, you know, maybe not really understanding what they need to do within the processes themselves. They'd be my key takeaways, really.
And do you think that there's been some new problems that HR professionals have been facing thanks to the pandemic?
Yeah. Can I come back in relation to that previous question? Just for Mary, like, literally, that was like two, like said so much, but two key things in relation to people not coming to the employment law solicitors soon enough is so bang on. And I think it's a fear of cost. I think they don't realize until they've been in the trenches, they don't realize that if you come to solicitor, the sooner you come, the actual more costs you save. Like, but I think it's a cost, fear of costs. And in relation to the other point, oh my goodness, the amount of HR that think they can have without prejudice conversations or off the record conversations, and try and engage in a resolution, and it's the timing of that approach, and not realizing that all of that approach is actually on the record if it's not between like two solicitors, like, so
yeah
that like, I was like, oh yeah, that's happened so much.
Even with trade unions, and when a trade union talks to a HR professional and says something like, you know, this is off the record, and the individual starts conversations with the trade union in an off the record basis, it's not privileged. No. And people seem to think it is, and that's just a misunderstanding in relation to it. But those side table conversations are important, but you've got to understand that they can come back and bite you at a later stage too.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And sorry, Sarah, in relation to your question there, the new issues that are rising, I mean, I was just looking at this from this time last year. I think it's like the new issues is obviously the issues in relation to vaccinations and testing, people returning to work. What does that look like? Is it a blended working? There's a lot of things about, you know, some employer clients are forgetting that they still have to, they're trying to come to grips with the blended working arrangement, the flexible working arrangement, but then there's this right to disconnect. And then the Organisation Working Time Act hasn't been updated to fix all of them together, because if you have a flexible working arrangement, you're not going to get the mandatory rest periods. And then how do you fix the right to disconnect within that? They all sort of contradict each other. And especially if there's remote working and one of the parents wants to just focus with the kids' homework, so they will be certain hours and they want to get back, or feeding the children, and then they want to get back to work when it's quieter. You know, that actually could suit the people, the individuals, but then the law doesn't permit it because it's so out of date. Like, so it's trying to facilitate and manipulate, like, get around all of those tricky aspects, you know, where both sides, where the employees and the employers are trying to, like, are all in agreement to do this. And then you've got outdated laws that you get an inspection, whether it's a WRC inspection or later down the line, the relationship goes south, and all of this becomes then not so good. So it becomes an issue. So trying to work, do workarounds for that. I also see there's some issues in relation to, you know, dealing with how employees conduct when they're working from home, you know, that they do have the calls in a confidential setting. They don't have it where their partner is listening in, that they are more mindful, you know, that this has to be confidential. And just where they leave documents and different things like that. And then there's a number of employees who have, they just, due to certain their own situations, they really need to get back into the office for their own health and safety, or for their own themselves, and to just be aware that, you know, it's you know, you've got to facilitate that person too. You've got to accommodate that person too. So yeah, and then there's the same stuff that keeps coming up in relation to redundancies and dismissals, and then the new aspect of redundancies, where unfortunately some companies that can't afford to go through a full 30-day consultation period, and then you're like laying off employees during that consultation period, you know, to be able to follow procedures. And employers are saying, we have to follow procedures when our business is so destroyed. And it's like, you have to convince them that, yeah, they do. So Mary probably has more examples.
Yeah, well, I think, and in a lot of cases, employers, we've gone through such an unbelievable year in terms of the pandemic that employers think that, well, we can just dispense with our normal approach to layoffs or redundancies or short time or salary reductions, those kind of things, because, you know, somewhere everyone's going to understand that these were amazing times and the law doesn't apply, and actually it does. And people are going to get caught short, I would guess, when they find themselves in front of tribunals or, you know, any third party setting, when they're trying to justify why they did what they did. And I presume all of that will start to wash through, and some of it has already, but I would presume we'll see more of it over the years ahead, when we look at, well, what did employers do and what lessons can we learn from how they behaved? But I also think that, you know, probably from a HR perspective, you know, the profession is probably predominantly female. There are lots of men in it, but it has been predominantly female. And so from a HR challenges perspective, that home caring and child care responsibilities have probably fallen to a lot of HR practitioners themselves, who have tried to balance and juggle hours of work and children and family and, you know, your homework set up. And I completely agree with you. And when it comes to, you know, what is that homework set up? Is it suitable? Is it private? You know, I'm lucky in that I have space in my home and I am able to work without children there. And I'm very grateful that my children are now grown up and I didn't have to deal with them at home for last year, because I think it would be tremendously challenging to do so. But, you know, what happens with information that's in your home? Printed information, where are you storing it? I think a lot of employers aren't really thinking those things through very carefully. And I think those kind of things are, you know, problematic right across every sector of the workforce. You know, how are we dealing with these challenges, these issues, these levels of confidentiality? What kind of monitoring are we doing of employees in their homes? You know, you hear an awful lot about systems where capturing images of people every 15 minutes. I don't know if you've come across any of that stuff. And in terms of keystrokes and monitoring their activity and all that. And it's just not a very humane approach to work.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of media spin as well on that. Like, I had this debate with one of my friends when it came up, and I said, well, look, I think in relation to the monitoring and checking in, I think that, sorry, in the workplace, they absolutely can check in with you and you're working and, you know, they're supposed to record your breaks. So, and employees need to be helped to record your breaks. So if you're working, they should be allowed. You're supposed to be in a work space. They should be able to do that. It's not an intrusion of privacy because you're working. Like, and that's where the whole, it'll be a whole new setting of boundaries. Because I do recall when the Health and Safety Act was updated to the current, the new Health and Safety Act came in. Well, it's not new anymore, but I mean, when it came in and the regulations, and literally people were, the home offices were, like, people were being sent out to home offices. There was, like, risk assessment in relation to people that were working in the cars, you know, journeying salesmen. Like, it was really, there was a lot of overkill in relation to when it first came out. And so I'm just going back to those type of assessments, but I think the HSA and their questionnaires online and stuff are very helpful, and they're really on top of that. But I just remember even wires had to be pinned down, and it was, yeah, anybody that worked from home, it was quite a huge job initially to have a working space under the Health and Safety Welfare Work Act. But I also, one of the new other matters that are coming in is getting employees to come back to work.
Yeah, it's a really big issue, isn't it? If someone has decided themselves that they're more productive or effective at home, or it just suits their life.
Or even if they're on PUP payments and they're like, do you know what? I'm happy on this for a bit longer. You're like, what? Yeah.
What would you recommend, Anne, if people are in a position where an employee refuses to come back?
I did recommend, I've dealt with this now a couple of times, and what the employer has done is written to the department, When at the time, the department did nothing and kept paying the employee. But now I've seen recently, just last week, that the department are actually putting more resources into that part of it, where they refuse to return to work. They are thankfully putting more resources into that. And so hopefully that'll help. But then what I've also said is, like, we've written, ghostwritten for the client to say, well, are you resigning? Your job is here. If you don't return to work by Monday, you know, we'll have to take the resign, you know, go down that route, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you don't, you know, we'll have to take it, you resigned. And because your job is here, we need you here. Please come back. We've asked you now twice, come back. And, you know, there's no medical issue for you not to be back. What else is it? So, yeah, I think that's the way to go down. Otherwise, you're going down a long disciplinary route.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're disciplining them. And perhaps, like, that's another issue about disciplining virtually, having disciplinary meetings virtually, which are more than likely going to be recorded by the employee. So that's where it's particularly in the catering industry and hotel industry, where they're just like, well, you know, we're happy with the hook payments at the moment,
mm-hmm.
you know, or where it's shift work and they're like not wanting to get back into shift work.
Mm. Yeah, it's understandable at the human level, isn't it?
You know, yeah.
Some people are being paid more than they ever got. While working, a lot of students in particular that might have been working in hotel catering bars, and they're doing far better, you know, on the PUP payment than they would do if they went back to the employer. I presume some of those issues are going to be reasonably short-lived, though. I mean, you would expect by the end of June that, you know, the government will have done something on the PUP payment, and then it's really going to be about a kind of peculiar setup, isn't it? That, you know, you're going to have some organisations that are hybrid or fully remote, and then you're going to have a raft of frontline workers who've got to go to work every day. And it's going to be interesting to see how that all plays out in society and in the workplace, particularly if you've got some frontline workers in the workplace and others that can have really flexible work practices, and yet you've got to come in and serve the customer or, you know, clean hotel rooms or do whatever, and all the administration staff can do it from home, you know. Mm-hmm. So it'll just be interesting to see how it'll work out. Do you have a view on when it comes to the right to request remote work, how it'll play out from an employer perspective?
I think it should be the same way as the right to request part-time work.
Mm.
I think that it should be. So it should, I think the employers will have to be seen and have records that they have considered the request. And but it isn't, you know, it can't be something that's mandatory. I think just once the employer has given reasons if they refuse it or if they allow it on a partial basis. I think, though, that they're coming from the place where so many people have been working for so long remotely, that I think more employers would be open to it than if we went from before people were remote working and then go into it. I think that you will see a lot of change. And I also think that there may be less people. I know that's not what's on the stats, but from talking to different people, I think a lot of people do want to get back into the office, at least part-time. I think they prefer the structure and they're more productive in the office, or they miss their colleagues. And I think the support that colleagues get, regardless of what job you're in, from other colleagues doing the same thing, I think people just feel a bit isolated. being at home in it. So I think that dynamic, and I wonder what you said there was really interesting about the relationship between those in the workplace who have to go in and those who are at work. I wonder, will there be a request to change roles where some want to, where their qualifications can manage that, you know, where one, like the grass is always greener on the other side, where one would actually prefer to be in work, another would prefer to be at home.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting because it's going to inorganize. I think if you can have everyone remote, or you can have all office based people in a, some kind of hybrid working arrangement or blended working arrangement, you know, I can see how that would work for your LinkedIns, your Googles, your eBays, you know, because the majority of people are, their jobs are suitable for remote working. But when you come to that kind of a mix, you know, if you've got your in your retail, you know, you can't do retail remotely. You've got to run your checkouts. Well, maybe I'm not thinking too far into the future. I'm sure they'll come up with all of this stuff, but there's a human element to a lot of jobs on the front line that you can't nurse remotely, you can't mind children remotely, but you can carry out certain administrative tasks remotely. So in a hospital, you've got your nurses, your doctors, your care assistants, your cleaners, your porters, your ambulance drivers, they all need to be in there, but your management don't, and your administration don't. And will it create inequalities and a two-tier structure? I wonder how it'll play out in the long term.
But then managers will need to be there to manage, you know.
Or do they? And that's the big question at the moment. Yeah. And do they actually need to be present to manage, or, you know, can we reimagine the workplace? And I think there's a lot of that talk going on at the moment, but it'll be interesting to see, you know, what kind of issues it'll throw up and what kind of challenges it'll throw up, and whether, you know, certain people get discriminated against by virtue of the fact that they choose to work remotely to balance maybe childcare or caring responsibilities for elderly people or whatever. And, you know, will that throw up inequalities because some people are able to go into the workplace and be seen because the managers are there and get promoted and get career opportunities or training opportunities that maybe you wouldn't get if you're, you know, at your screen or continuing to be at your screen with very little interaction in the workplace at the human level. I think it's going to be a very interesting time. And hopefully it won't be the ugly side of HR, but it could be.
Going to take a while to kind of iron things out, and there's going to be teething issues, isn't there, with all these kind of remote work models or hybrid working models as well. Anne, I was kind of talking with Mary a little bit before the episode about some of the things that we'd love to ask you when you joined us. And one of the things that came up was this use of a termination agreement. You know, the termination of employment is obviously a difficult one to get right, as we can see from the number of claims for unfair dismissal that wind up in court. So when might an organisation use a termination agreement, and what kind of thing do they need to be aware of?
It actually touches on the point that Mary raised earlier about, you know, having the off the record conversations. Mm-hmm. Basically a termination agreement is used where it should be used where the employer tends to give more payment over and above the statutory and contractual entitlements that an employee is to give. And so in a redundancy situation, if they want to give an additional payment, well, then that could be in consideration of them signing a waiver and release. And where it's a redundancy situation, I would usually have a letter and waiver as opposed to a big termination agreement. So it's less daunting, like a turn and redundancy is about the position as opposed to the individual, you know, but it still lists, it's a one page waiver, lists all the legislation, say that you've got an opportunity, you've got legal advice for signing it. The letter explains the whole redundancies and refers to previous meetings. So it's all recorded and, you know, and any ongoing obligations to remind them of obligations that, that still exist after the termination. So that would be redundancy. In another situation, it would be where you've reached, where there's a dispute or where you've terminated somebody on a no-fault basis. So that is where you've actually just given somebody a letter. Employer has decided they're going to take on the risk. They're going to, it'll be a slam dunk unfair dismissal case, but they're not going to, their fear would be an injunction. So they're willing to pay an employee and negotiate. So they will usually like write a letter of termination and say, you know, this is nothing to do with you or your performance. You know, we are in line with your contract. We're giving you notice of termination of your employment. We're going to pay you in lieu. And please see attached agreement for you to review, get legal advice. And this is what we're offering you in ex gratia payment. And the key thing, though, in those is that that termination and the fact of the termination agreement, that's all on the record. So, you know, that is all evidence, but you've actually exercised the termination is coming to effect. So what the thing that, which Mary touched on earlier is that where you're in a disciplinary process and particularly where there's been misconduct or managers have lost patience where it's a performance issue and they're like, oh, good God, I can't keep going. So, and there it rises like, should we, you know, the employee has approached maybe or raised the issue. It can be the employee that raises it or one of the managers said, look, we'll pay this amount, you know, to terminate. And the key thing there is not to, to make sure that you don't impact on the actual validity of the disciplinary process if you can't reach an agreement. So you're better off to actually go through the disciplinary process and only at the time where you've got the decision in written and you actually have decision in one hand and an agreement in the other hand. So it's not tainting the actual disciplinary process because it's all occurred. So it can't then be used against the employer to say you predetermined the outcome of the disciplinary process by producing an agreement in advance. So it is better to do it, you know, after the disciplinary process.
Yeah, you haven't issued the sanction as
such. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
But presumably you would have entered into some form of discussion with the employee about what that sanction might be, or no?
I would have had usually you try and say, you'd indicate that I have a sanction here and this is the sanction. Now I can give you this letter or I can give you this termination agreement and offer you this. You know, so go away and think about it.
Yeah.
Come back to me.
And it's a tricky one because, you know, sometimes in HR, you know, you've got to be very commercial and practical in HR as well. And you've got the competing management needs and operational needs and bottom line needs. And someone approaches you and they have no patience for going through a PIP process plus the disciplinary process, all of which may take in excess of 12 months. In the meantime, they're looking at their profits or they're looking at their productivity. They're looking at, you know, whatever element of the business isn't working because someone's not performing. And they do put it to HR, you know, how can we terminate the employment of this person? And I see a lot of HR managers and HR professionals making mistakes at that point in time because they come under pressure from the business. And the business is making good commercial arguments for speeding up the process or you know, moving on with it, skipping stages or whatever it is that they might push you to do. And again, I would always be saying to HR practitioners, you know, it's at those points you need your legal advice so that you don't make really serious errors, like bring somebody into a meeting room before you've even started a disciplinary process, before you've even outlined any case against an employee. We can do this the nice way, we can do this the hard way. I shudder when I hear it. I mean, it's something that would have been said, you know, 25 years ago when I started out in HR, and it's such an outdated and outmoded practice, but yet I still hear about it today.
Mm-hmm. I'm just like, are you serious? You're going to go down a PIP route? Like, have you already decided that you want rid of this employee? Well, then you shouldn't be going down the PIP route. It really stands for patience in procedures, and people don't have us. Like, so, but yes, it's changing and skipping and taking that risk on and going after one PIP to dismissal. It's like, guys, you're going to have to pay up then, you know. So, yeah. But then depending, the WRC, I think, changed the whole quantum in relation to the risks of the potential awards. And it'll be interesting to see whether with the new legislation that's required to come in now after the Supreme Court decision, whether that will have an impact again on awards. So whether it'll go back to being potentially bigger because it's all in public, it'll be all heard in public now. And, you know, will that impact on the adjudicator's decisions?
Do you think that will influence both employers and employees to settle something externally and privately because they
absolutely
want to appear in public? Because I can imagine that it's a much more daunting process for everybody involved, including the solicitors and the barristers. You know, if you're going to be, you know, anyone can view it, any reporter can view it, any member of the general public, it could affect your, you know, your ability to attract and retain. Your own employees could be sitting on looking at how badly you have treated somebody online from their home desktop. And you know, it'll be interesting to see, will it reduce the amount of people actually going that far?
Yeah, I think that it'll be back to the EAT days. But the thing about, and I think that, like that, where the employee went to the rights commissioner, which would have been the former, like before in EAT, she wouldn't pay much attention to the rights commissioner because you're like, sure, it's going to come to the EAT anyway, and then we'll pay attention. And because that's in public when the rights commissioner hearing was in private. So I absolutely think that people will, I think employers will look to, it depending on what the employee is looking though for. I think employers will look to resolve it quicker because of their, you know, their own, what's the point of spending money on PR? And then you have one hearing and can destroy you. And that's why injunctions are so powerful, because they get so much media attention. So I think the WRC will, that will impact. I think there will be more resolutions, and particularly when adjudicators are so unpredictable, because they're so, it's such a very varied qualifications in relation to the adjudicators.
Interesting times.
It is indeed. I've just noticed the time, guys. We've covered so much, and it seems like the time has just flown, but I think we're going to have to wrap it up. And just before we do, what's the best way for people to get in touch with you?
I think email is probably the best just at the moment. The phone's a bit crazy. So email is the best at Anne, A-N-N-E, at aocsolicitors.ie.
Perfect. We'll add that to the little episode description as well on our player. So we're going to wrap it up there. Before we do, and this is the point of the podcast episode, Anne, where I go looking through my notes and trying to read my writing, I'm going to try and summarize the whole episode in 3 takeaway points, which I think is actually going to be a bit impossible for today's episode. A lot of the mistakes that HR professionals make tend to be down to communication errors. So it's not enough to simply know what you're doing. You need to be able to communicate clearly what you're doing to your employees, but you also need to be able to document your process. It's not just a nice to have document, you know, you might actually need to show an external party at some point that you did follow due process. So make sure that you're documenting everything as you go along. My second takeaway is that you should be training your line managers because a lot of mistakes get made at this level. So, you know, you really need to do a skills audit, identify where your line managers might need training and seek help externally if needs be, you know your own limitations. There might be a skills gap or a knowledge gap within your team. So you might need to look externally for that training provider. My third takeaway then is that involving an employment lawyer sooner rather than later can actually end up saving you money in the long run. Sometimes employment lawyers are brought on to help a little bit too late. And if they'd been brought on to help before, then they could have prevented things getting out of hand or escalating. A lot of problems can be prevented. So just kind of bear that in mind. And yeah, involve your employment lawyer as soon as you think you might need to. So yeah, that's the 3 takeaways that I have from today's episode. Thanks very much for joining us today, Anne, and thanks very much for joining us today, Mary.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks for joining us today on the HR Room podcast, the podcast series from Insight HR that helps you create the human resources systems and workplace culture that's right for your business. For show notes and bonus content, go to www.insighthr.ie/podcast. That's www.insighthr.ie/podcast. We'd love it if you subscribe, like, and share the show with any friends and colleagues who are looking for fresh ideas on how to create the ideal workplace for their business. And remember, if you need any HR support, get in touch with us at Insight HR. Whether it's conducting a complex workplace investigation, filling a gap by providing you with a virtual or an on-site HR resource, or providing advice via our HR support line, we'll help you resolve whatever human resources challenge your business is facing. Thanks, and see you soon.